from how well I did from Forrest, how being Forrest motivated me to train. I would always try and look at Forrest after a race, and I would use their emotion as a memory, they always kept me honest, kind of thing. Like the how hard is the person who is fourth training right now, because they are heartbroken and hungry, and that's where you need to be for the whole year.
That's three-time Olympic gold medalist Marty McBean, and this is Difference Makers, a Christina Walker podcast. Hello, everyone. Welcome back, or welcome to Difference Makers. I'm your host, Christina Walker. This week, we have a very special guest, Canada's chef de mission for the Tokyo 2020 Olympics, Marty McBean. Marty competed in the 92 and 96 Olympics, bringing home 3 gold medals and 1 bronze. Throughout this conversation, we talk a lot about rowing, which for me, I could have gone all day, as I think so could Marty. We also discuss what the preparation for this summer has looked like for Canadian athletes, as well as diving into the values of determination and dedication. Marty is one of a kind, and I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Before we get going, once again, this podcast is sponsored by Marathon Surfaces, suppliers of rubberized surfacing for running tracks, walking paths, and safety surfacing for playgrounds. Now please enjoy the one and only Marty McBean.
I remember some of the races, watching some of the races in Rio and in those terrible conditions, and watching how our athletes responded to not the A game, not the A plan, and not even the B plan. And how you recover from that is often a result of lots of racing, right? Being able to anticipate what to do. And so Michelle and Terry are amazing for that, right? But, you know, just it's like, you know, when shitty things happen, you can't win the race in the next 2 strokes, but you can win the race in the next 30 strokes. And I can tell you for sure, because in that 95 season that you weren't alive yet for, you know, Kathleen and I won a race at the World Championships where the stroke where we took the lead was the stroke that we also crossed the finish line. Right. So you just have to have patience. You do not have to be winning a race at the 1500 meter mark, and nobody gives a shit who is winning the race at the 1500 meter mark. So you just have to have patience and know that, that you're going to cross the finish line. Like in that last one, like the men's 8 race just recently in Lucerne, right? Like it's a bow ball at the finish line, and that's the only one that matters.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so true. Did you ever have any sort of loss of hope during like races like that, or you're just so completely internal?
Hell yeah. Same race actually, where, so Kathleen and I, and I'm sure we'll talk a lot about Kathleen here. I'm happy to do that. But so at the World Championships in 95, we actually had this huge misunderstanding. Like we went through part of the regatta where we didn't talk to each other for a day. Like she crossed a line for like in that she didn't come home one night. She stayed, her husband was actually her boyfriend at the time, but she stayed in his room that night. And that was, you know, she admitted later that was about as bad as it got. But we had a huge misunderstanding. Anyways, but I'm happy to go into that, but I'm a champion at making a long story longer. I'm going to try not to.
Nice.
But so in that race, at the finals in the women's double for the World Championships, we were being good. But good's not enough to put you in the front. And so we were being good and we're coming along, and I couldn't even see the Dutch. They were so far ahead of us. I'm like, I don't even know where they are. And you get to a point where you just, you know this is about, you're supposed to be able to look here and see them, but you're not supposed to be able to do this and turn your whole body and see them. Like that's going to disrupt everything. And it's not like I'm sculling. I don't have that. Like, I'll just do it when I'm out at the catch. Right. Yeah. No. Right. So I gave up on where the Dutch were. And it's actually not even the only race. If I think about 92 in the pair, we had a race where I'll have to get back to that one. But I gave up on them. But then New Zealand was coming up on our inside. I was like, no goddamn way they're going to pass us. Like, nobody passes us in the last 250 ever.
Yeah.
So then we're having to really dig down a little bit to stay ahead of New Zealand. And then as we're doing that, New Zealand gave us, and they were in a wind aided lane, I'm going to say, as New Zealand's coming along with the advantage of being out of the crosshead, they were phenomenal anyways, but anyways, so now I can see the Dutch. And so now I'm like, oh, okay, I'll start calling off of them again. All right. Like, there they are, here we go. And then we just sort of pluck away at them, and and we beat them by 0.04 that day. And they were pretty pissed. And then the next day in the quad, we were ahead the whole time, but they were closing us, and we beat them by 0.2 in the quad.
Oh my gosh.
Over 4K, we beat the same girls by 0.24, right?
Wow.
I used that. I parked that in my brain for all of the 95 to 96 season, right? Like, I always thought of, I learned this pretty from how well I did from fourth, how being fourth motivated me to train. I always tried to find, like, I would always try and look at fourth after a race, and I would use their emotion as a memory, they always kept me honest, kind of thing. Yeah. Like, the how hard is the person who is fourth training right now, because they are heartbroken and hungry, and that's where you need to be for the whole year.
Wow. I love that. And not allowing yourself to kind of go through that emotion, but kind of experience that through somebody else. So, I mean, I'd say,
yeah, well,
wisdom,
I did it.
Right?
I lived it the first time we were fourth, you know, it was so exciting, right? That it was just this whole new world for Western rowing, not like anyone who spoke English, right? We were fourth. That was amazing. Like, I'm going way back, but it used to be rowing was dominated by Romania and East Germany and the Soviets.
Yeah.
Western nations. It was almost like if you spoke English, just don't even anticipate you're going to go anywhere near the podium. And then, so we were fourth as this really young four, like, so my first year I raced in 89, we were fourth in the four. And yes, that's why I'm like, it is such a fun boat. Like, I remember how fast and light and flighty it is. So the first time we were fourth, we're like, God, that was awesome. And I remember my Timex triathlon, right? I would sit there in class, my classes at Western, I'd sitting there like typing in 0.9, like seeing if I could go 0.96 point, like that's because we were 0.96 behind the Romanians.
Oh, wow.
It was awesome. It was a great year. And then the next year we were fourth in Tasmania, again in the four, we were crushed. Like, we're like that. We had really let an opportunity down. And what had happened there was, it was a really crazy headwind. It's funny, when I talk to a rower, I can remember all my rowing stories. It's so much fun for me right now. Like, this is a long time ago. You're like, well, yeah. Like, my parents weren't even married now, we were racing this four, and we believed we were strong enough to get a medal. Like, I didn't think we probably knew that we couldn't beat East Germany at the time. They were still like, just on paper, like that wasn't realistic for us, but it was realistic for us to think that we could get on the podium, to beat Romania probably. We're racing along, and I remember halfway through this race, we were right beside East Germany.
Wow.
And after the race, all of us talked about that moment, that we looked over and we're like, it was kind of like a, oh, holy fuck kind of moment. And it shut us down. Like, right. Like, it was this headwind, we're pressing into it. And like, man, like, it's almost like we felt that we were in the wrong place, because we were up beside East Germany. And all of us the next year, we realized that, what we had done going into that race is we'd been really consistent with saying stuff like, you know, this is going well, we're really strong this year, you know, this could be a good year. But we never got more specific than that. And,
right.
And like, you know, with a great race, we can, you know, and you should be able to say this, with a great race, I'm going to take down, we can be on the podium. Like, we, with a great race, we can go with anybody, right? If we're having a great race and they're having a bad race, there's no reason why we can't beat anyone.
And
right?
did you believe that with, when you guys first won the fourth, your first place in fourth, was that
That sound like, well, it was a surprise. So then did your expectations just totally shift of like, oh, we want more?
The first time we were fourth, I would say we were, and that whole quadrennial a little bit young and dumb. Like we just loved rowing and going hard and fast. And it was the first time we were fourth. It was a surprise. We had no idea. And it wasn't like, you know, this is before a time when anyone was racing so much. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't an idea. We had no clue of what to expect, right? They weren't keeping standards. You know, there wasn't like an international comparison of any sort. You know, we didn't have an idea of how our team or how the other team had done last year. Like we were super young and dumb.
Yeah.
Which is a blessing, man. Mm-hmm. Like that's something you want to take through your whole career. If you can hold on to that emotion, that's a great thing too.
Nice. Okay. So then that second race where you guys came fourth again,
we just knew we'd let ourselves down. It wasn't like one of those fourths where you're bawling on the side or like that. It wasn't like, mm-hmm. It's the year, it's a mid Olympic quadrennial, right? It's like 90, yeah. It's not 92. So, we were pretty disappointed. And the other thing that we had been doing, within North America is we've been doubling up and we used to crush the Americans all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, I know it's, you know, they are way more organized now, but, it was so much fun. They always showed up with all the talent in the world, but they weren't organized and we just beat them all the time. And we would like walk in like these, like, you know, like it was almost like we were the rural kids coming and they're like all fancy with all their like fancy equipment and gear. And we would just beat them. And I was like, oh yeah, that was us. and you know, this, for me, it was, anyways, all these names that would mean nothing to you now. But anyways, so the Americans then raced the eight the next day and got a medal. And we all sitting on a hill watching that race. Mm-hmm. And that was like, whew, there was a lot of air kind of leaving the room for us. And we're like, we're not leaving opportunities on the table. And the next year we showed up the Worlds. We doubled up and we had the sense that nobody had trained harder than us and nobody was... you know, and we felt that like, we knew everyone's doing like, you know, maybe similar volume and mm-hmm. whatever, but the way we trained against each other, the competitive nature of how we dug into every stroke. Like I remember doing, competitive pieces on the erg for like 20 minutes out of 24 and we would get really mad at each other. I remember like looking over at Jesse Monroe and like, you're at 25, like, like self-policing all the time. And mm-hmm. the technology we had even for monitoring our stroke rate was pretty rudimentary. Like it was better for us to count, right? To do like time 15 seconds and count, mm-hmm. multiply by four. We had this one, our first stroke coach, if you went below a 10, it turned off. And Kathleen and I had drills where we would go below 10 just to make it turn off, kind of thing. Like, you knew your low rate rowing was good when the thing turned off.
Oh gosh. And how did that affect your team culture? That sort of competitiveness, that sort of like ruthless competitiveness when you're then going back in a boat with somebody or a few of your teammates, how do you deal with that?
I think I took it for granted. You know, that group of women was incredible. You know, sometimes I wonder, like even talking this through, was like, were we being competitive or were we being dedicated? Like, I don't know, because if we were being competitive, like it was very competitive and we really cared about everything and every stroke and we recorded everything. And, you know, even whether we were in London comparing to ourselves or we're in Victoria comparing against standard to the men's team. Mm-hmm. But what I took for granted was how you could be so like all the, you know, I was starboard. So when we were in the small boats worked as bow and, you know, whether I'm like talking to Kirsten Barnes or all the starboards, we'd be mm-hmm. kind of, and I'm going to take, I was the lead chirper at each other, but you know, for, holding our course straight. Like, you know, if we're going to be in the same lake, you better be right beside each other, even though there's no lanes, like don't go wandering all over the lake. Steer, like we were very, but then we're like, oh, where are you going for coffee after? Mm. So, a lot of that came from us. A lot of that was also shepherded by Al.
Yeah.
You know, and he would tell us stories like just how, you know, if a crew, if a group, like the whole group, and then they always left in the same car every day. Mm-hmm. To go to the same, like, so this group of four went to that coffee shop and this group of four went to that coffee shop. And, you know, this group of four goes to the other coffee shop. Then you've got three groups. And if they aren't mixing, like you had to be mixing it up all the time. You can't stay in your pods, and how we changed roommates and stuff like that. But he, and we were never expected to be everybody's buddy and mm-hmm. friend. But there was a lot of expectation to earn each other's respect around you. So like, I was like, yeah, that was just easy. And we could be really hard on each other. Mm-hmm. And like I said about the erg races and stroke rates, whether it was on the erg or on the water, we could be like kind of jawing at each other for, you know, whether you thought somebody was cheating a stroke rate, you could be really on them.
Yeah.
And then you'd leave and you'd be like, hey, that was a great workout. Or, you know, it was so like that. And then I think how I realized I took it for granted was when that group mostly retired after the 92 Olympics. And, you know, I tried to slide in, and I didn't totally slide in because I switched to sculling. Mm-hmm. But some maybe more when I came back, I took 97 season off, and then 98, I came back and I was in the four and the eight. So I raced mm-hmm. the four again in 98. And that was when I was like, I would try and kind of talk the same way with some of the athletes, and they would cry. And I was like,
oh, wow.
Right. I have to do this really different. And Leslie would just look at me and shrug, because she knew that I was really frustrated. Like, I actually didn't misunderstand, because I don't know who you've talked to. And I feel like I'm, you know, I possibly self-declaring, but sometimes there runs a risk of, especially with women, when they are athletes like me, that I could be labeled as mean.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think I was ever mean. I think I really wasn't. And then, or I didn't intend to be. And then mm-hmm. when I realized I was making people cry, I backed off on that. And I have to admit, I probably had less respect for that person. Mm-hmm. You know, but they were young, and I probably just needed to manage where we were in our careers also a little differently. Mm-hmm. So part of me, I had a lot to learn.
Yeah, it sounded like, it sounds like you had such like a ruthless pursuit of excellence. And I mean, you were in the game for a certain period of time, and that culture that you guys built within 92, everyone was on the same page and everyone believed in that, right? And then when you go and have it, new generations come in, and I do think it sometimes is a generational thing. And I mean, I've even noticed that within my career, where like certain teams are so different. Everyone's so different. And you could be one way with this team, and then you go to another team and you have to be like completely different, or else they're taking it more personal, which is like, from what I'm getting from you, is that you were just so focused, like you said, dedicated, right? And you might have not have been super competitive, or if you guys want to call it competitive, you're just talking about complete dedication. And I mean, I can respect that and understand that, absolutely.
And possibly I had a lot of work to do on my EQ kind of thing, but you know, I was also, I felt this quite fervently that it was not my job to make friends, right? It was my job, especially as bow,
right,
to make the boat better. Mm. And you know, with Kathleen, it worked really well, because we would talk about this and people are like, no way, she was in on it. But like, we had a bad cop, good cop. There was times when in the quad particularly, so we were very experienced and had an idea of what we were doing, and Larissa and Diane had a lot to learn about racing and managing the pressures that were on us. Mm-hmm. And I remember one thing was going really bad at one point, and what was going really bad was something that had been going really well, so we were having the yips on something. And so I just said to Kathleen, I'm going to do this drill, and it's not going to go well, but we're going to do this drill. and I'm going to get us through these yips. And when it's after, I want you to go to this athlete. She's like, got it. Right. And then she'll go and just say, well, Marnie's just getting us through the yips. And sometimes she's like this, don't worry about it. You're great. You're amazing. You're awesome. Mm-hmm. And she would come in her very Kathleen quiet kind of way and do it her own way. But Kathleen wanted us to get through the yips also, because we're all relying on each other. And, you know, I remember Colleen and Wendy in the lightweight double. I think it was Wendy who said once, and you know, they were the world champions for 3 years. And then unfortunately a virus took them down, at the Sydney Olympics. No, the Atlanta Olympics. Anyways, but, they're like, sometimes you just got to be the bitch on board, and it's not a nasty thing. Like, the bitch on board isn't about being, but it's the person who on any given day is like, and you know what, you're about, this is you, when you're having a good row, your job is to go, okay, today was a good row, but we're looking for great today. So let's go and do a little more. We can do a little hard. That was pretty beige, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that was a beige good row. And you know what? I would like color and salsa and peppers, and let's put a little jalapeno on this. And right. It's your job as Bao to make sure that the row is always seasoned and spicy. Mm. And when it's going like good, when it feels like comfortable, it's not enough.
Right.
And so my job was always, it's like, yeah, comfortable is lovely. Right. And certainly we could have those recovery rows. Recovery rows are allowed to be comfortable. They're certainly not allowed to be boring either, right? Mm-hmm. There's no stroke that we take that's like less than dynamic, right? That whole concept of the controlled explosion. But anyways.
Yeah, no, what was that line of sort of being that intense teammate, like you're talking about, and like what you say of coming across as being mean? Or because it sounds like you still got the best out of your teammates, considering you guys won numerous medals. But how do you come across that way with them? Not like, how do you not be somebody's
hating
friend?
Me.
Yeah, you know.
So before back in it was early on, you know, like, I guess it was that second time we were fourth. Mm-hmm. I remember sitting on the hill, you know, we just watched the American eight get a medal. And then Al sort of pulled me over, and he was pulling everybody over and talking to like, okay, you know, we're going to go back and start training for next year. And this is what we're going to do. Like, we're already at the regatta and talking about, you know, when we're coming back into camp and when we're training for the next year. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you know, Marnie, nobody wants to row with you. And I was like, cause what I wanted was for everybody to want to row with me. Right. Like when I came into the system, I remember hearing about how everybody wanted to row with Tricia Smith. Right. Cause she was just such a smooth boat mover and just beautiful technique. And right. And I was like, I want to be that rower. And so I was doing that physically. Right. I was like, my technique was good. My power was great. You know, my intensity on the water was great, but I was being a real cow to people. And certainly how I was being about was very personal and very directed. Didn't sound like I was including myself at all. Mm-hmm. So I hated hearing what Al told me, but it was a very good thing to hear. And then, you know, I had to go back and I had to figure out different things, right? Like, so Kathleen was an introvert, and I had to stop chirping at her and stop trying to make her be me. So I had to be the Bao, like, with the intensity that I wanted to like push in. I also had to be aware of who the people in the boat were.
Right.
You know, and so when I, you know, when I came back into the program, like I said, you know, I was making people cry. That's my EQ is really low. And I wasn't aware of who these people were in the boat. Like I thought I knew, I thought I was just, I was reading the other people in the boat poorly. Like I knew what was right for performance. But it wasn't right for that group quite yet. Or I needed to talk to them about what I was doing. Right. Mm-hmm. Like, there is some method to the madness, and this is me, and it's not about you. And, you know, it's like sometimes when a coach comes in and they're just being really critical at you, sometimes you just want the coach to tell you, I actually think you're excellent. right? You're excellent. And what I'm doing is I'm critiquing you, and you're at the top of the mountain. Mm-hmm. Right. So I want, you to know, when I'm critiquing you, it's not because I think you haven't even started on the mountain. You are at the top of the mountain, and you are very good, but we still need to get better. And you just want, because, you know, after a while, you just think that they're telling you you're terrible.
Yeah, that's so true. It is. And like, how do you then deal with that internally? And I think that's a lot of like self-reflection and being able to figure out like, okay, the end goal is this. So how do I get there? And it sounds like you repositioned your approach and then was able to then get more out of like, what did you find that you did differently after that conversation with Al? Or
I considered other people more, mm-hmm. you know, instead of just considering about what I needed and what I wanted and how I was going to get to be the best. And, you know, I considered Kathleen a lot more, right? Mm-hmm. I considered, you know, and you told me you guys have just finished your selection. I remember, I think it was April 4th, 1992, where, you know, I was finally told that I would be in the pair with Kathleen, right? And I just, that was... clearly that was an important day to me because I just remembered the date off of my head, but that was a day I could call my parents and say like, I'm still in the pair with Kathleen, right? We'd been the world champions in 91, and Jesse Monroe really put my feet in the fire quite a bit for my seat. Kathleen was so secure, mm-hmm. but it was pretty tough on this for my starboard seat with Jesse.
Wow. Yeah. I think that's also very remarkable to have teammates that push your caliber up like in that year, you know, being able to do really well with Kathleen and then still go through another whole year of training and then not know if you're going to be in the boat or not.
Right. But yeah, it was like, I think that was one of the things, like when we went to, like you sort of asked me about mindset a while ago, but when we went to, I guess the world's in 91, for sure the world's in 91 for the first time, and then 92. I actually, the racing in Canada, domestic racing in Canada was harder than internationally, right? So our top three pairs, so in 91, our women's four was going to also be, they were going to be world champs, and they set a world best time that it took, I think, 20 years for anyone to beat mm-hmm. their time that they set in 91. We set a world best time, like the depth, and then our 8-1. So our second, our fourth pair was excellent. Our fifth pair mm-hmm. was excellent, right? Like our,
that's
like
remarkable.
You know, if you think of our 92, 8, we lost Jenny, who mm-hmm. was in our top six, and replaced with Shannon, who was in our top 10, and we still clobbered the field, kind of thing, right? So we had the depth we had for racing, and like this is I go back to, we were so confident from mm-hmm. the intensity that we had in our own training camp, whether we were doing, you know, a point A to point B at 2022, mm-hmm. we were so competitive at a 22, and we learned to pull so hard. When you couldn't take more strokes, you had to take better strokes. Mm-hmm. So then when we got to take more strokes, when it went above 32, when we're like 34, and I know you guys race at higher rates than us, but like 36 was pretty high for us. We were pulling the same dedication to each stroke as we put in at 22, because we knew if you went one, like the second half of your stroke, if you weren't there, that was it. That was the ball game, right? So, so when we got to like the depth of competition we had, you know, was pretty extraordinary within Canada.
And do you think that was a testament to all of your teammates? I mean, obviously it sounds like it's probably multiple factors, or your coach, like, was it like, where was that sort of value instilled? And it sounds like you guys were just all champions that just wanted to bring the best out of everybody. But where did that actually come from?
Yeah, it was just kind of a magic time. Oh, did you hear that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just, I don't know. Sometimes in hindsight, I think it was just this magic fortune of all the right people coming together at the right time. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen it or I'm sometimes if I, when I come into you guys, your camp, I show it. I don't know if I have, there's a video and it's on my Vimeo page called Fast Friends. And mm-hmm. it's our profile from the 92 Olympics. And it talks about all the different rowers and all the different types of leaders and how we all led differently. Like sometimes I was leading and sometimes I was definitely, watching Kay lead or Brenda or mm-hmm. Kirsten or Jenny, right? Like there was all these incredible leaders in the boat who sort of took the lead on different things, whether it was going to be emotional or competitive or technical, mm-hmm. Theoretical, you know, like just, we all took the lead at different times. And, you know, it wasn't like it was a team of giants, right? Like yeah. I'm 5'10". And Kirsten and Jenny are taller than I am. Kathleen was taller than I am. But Brenda was shorter. Actually, I think Kirsten's shorter. I can't remember, maybe. Anyways, like we weren't tall. Like we had two girls in the boat who weighed like 145 pounds, right? Yeah, well. But they would still, like if you asked them to do a 2000 meter erg, they probably would have pulled like 642, 643 kind of thing.
Oh my goodness.
Right. And I say that because I was pulling 640 and went out and we used to do 2500s. So in 92, we were doing mm-hmm. 2500s, but we were always like within, the whole group of us would be within 5 seconds. Wow. And so when Kathleen and I sort of moved, we were like pretty much the only ones who moved on to the 2000 meter test. Mm-hmm. When we were like, she was 640 and I was 641 or something like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was like, I just know that those guys would have been there too.
Wow. Yeah.
And Jesse was 641. She also did the 2000 meter test. So.
Wow. Yeah. That is like, it's remarkable. And it's amazing that it was so organic in the way that happened, but it's something that I get fascinated by is like, how do you make that simulate that in other areas and in our team now, and like just trying to get that, you know, that sort of same feeling that you guys talk about, or, cause it is really special and it is very unique.
Yeah. I think it's some way that you come and you all kind of buy into being competitive and professional and not taking it personally. Mm-hmm. And although you do take it personally because you care so much about it, right? Like it's not a personal attack, right? Like critical feedback is not a personal attack. When your teammates come and they sort of say, well, this is what we're thinking here. And I don't even think we ever did that with anybody. It was more like we would have a meeting. We had a lot of meetings, right? Mm-hmm. And Al was the king of a 60-minute meeting with about 5 minutes of information.
Yeah.
Nice. But the thing was, and I learned this after a while, is we often took different chunks of 5 minutes from it. So I'd leave mm-hmm. and go, this 5 minutes was really good. And Kathleen was like, oh, well, this is what I heard. And Brenda was like, she heard this and Jesse heard that. And, you know, mm-hmm. just we all brought in something different. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, the more that you guys have come together and figured out how to push each other in a way that works for you, because mm-hmm. it's not going to be the same, right? Like there's so yeah. much that is different now. Well, there's a lot of things that are the same. It's still the boat. You're still trying to make it go faster.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just, I think ultimately it's passing the torch on any given day amongst all of you in the boat on making sure that you can enjoy the good days, but you know it's not about the good days. Like mm-hmm. you have to break down your good days to find your great ones. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, something that we did all the time. We kind of thrived in figuring out how to make it a little uncomfortable,
like on a daily basis as well.
Yeah. The workouts weren't going to be fun. And like, there's like, honestly, I'm thinking of a quote from Brenda in the video. And she's like, nobody's cutting corners out there. Right. Like it's either Brenda or Jesse. I think it's Jesse. We're like, we're not cutting corners out there. Nobody cuts a corner. And I remember even my single, when I wanted to cut a corner, I'd be like, you know, like, I can't do this because, you know, those guys wouldn't do it, or, you know, the Romanians would go to the buoy, or, like, you know, this is like the fifth piece is the most important piece, and the third piece is the one you're getting all, like, you know, you just sell yourself on why every piece you're doing is the most important piece you're doing at that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, a lot of internal negotiation. What were some of the difference between 92 and 96, both at the Olympics and in training?
I don't know, it was like the 92 approach, like the whole quadrennial campaign, that was the word I was looking for. So the 92 campaign, there was something kind of just natural about it, right? The way the men's team was training, the women's team was training, we would overlap, we would do pieces. Our coaches were a little combatant, right? Like, mm-hmm. so there was like a little Al Morrow v. like Mike Spracklin going on in there. And the rowers were just like, we didn't take it so personally. Like, we would all defend our coach, but on the water, we were really happy when, you know, the men's four would do pieces against the women's eight. And we had classic workouts like that, or, you know, and then, so training to 96, so there was like a more mature approach to it. So, you know, Kathleen and I were sculling. And if I just jump to the last year and a half, because Kathleen was out, she didn't come back really until the very end of the 94 season. Mm. You know, there you have all these scullers. So it had been Michelle and Derek and myself sculling, and all of us were first and second in the world. Like, that was like super cool to go to the world championships in 93 and to have this like dominance in sculling. We're like, oh, that was really cool. And then, so as we're going into the 96 Olympics, you know, whereas Kathleen and I didn't really have the huge training group, because the women's eight was going through like the forever selection, right? They were doing selection forever. And Kathleen and I were just like, oh my gosh. And then, you know, we got the, it was Larissa and Diane in the quad. And so we would try like go off in the double, but we did a lot of training. I recall a lot of training with Derek. Mm. You know, Silken had spent a lot of time in San Diego. And so when Derek would come into our training camp, it was such an excellent training, like always looking for someone to compete against, I guess.
Yeah.
And recognizing that, you know, if we just did a 500 meter piece, Derek was going to beat us because men are like so powerful.
Yeah.
But if we did a 1,000 meter piece, we would win, or 1,500 meter piece, we would win. Right. So then it was like this knowing who was going to do what. So we would try to take advantage of like, let's try and be more powerful like him. And then he would try and be more enduring like us. One of the other things that was always really good for us, and we applied it to both campaigns, was, you know, going to 92, it was small boat, big boat, right? Mm-hmm. So we've really focused on the pair and the four. And then we would like, I don't know if it's as legendary for you guys as it was for us, but when we won the world championships in the eight in 91, Leslie had clocked it. We hadn't done 100K in the eight, right? Like always just thrown together. And so she was determined that we would do more than 100K going into 92.
Yeah.
But, you know, we would talk about it. We would talk about, like, we left nothing to chance. We talked, and that was maybe going back to that race where we were beside the East Germans and we hadn't articulated it. Mm-hmm. We would talk about everything. Like, what do we want to do? How do we do the pair and the eight? Well, what is the pair? And the pair requires us to be really technical and precise and, you know, like really like fluid, like moving the boat along beautifully.
Yeah.
And what makes a great eight? Well, they are crazy aggressive and dynamic and explosive. And, you know, so we can't row the eight like a pair. And we can't row the pair like an eight, but we can try and bring some of those, like, we can try and bring some of that more like quick explosiveness into our pair. And we can try and take more of that technical prowess into the eight, but we need to row the eight like the eight and the pair like the pair.
Yeah.
And so we did that also. We need to do that a bit going into 96, which was just harder because the Germans were just so damn good in the quad. And we just always had this trying to figure out how to take them down in that boat. But that was also, it wasn't just Kathleen and I, it included, you know, younger athletes. So, and who excellent. But bringing Larissa and Diane along into sort of that sort of mindset of how to do one and how to just be comfortable and confident. Like it's hard. And I know as chef, it's kind of what I want to do. And when I'm mentoring, I want you guys to figure out how to feel as comfortable just going as hard as you can in the Olympic environment as you do, on Vancouver Island. Mm-hmm. Right. Because that's people don't rise up in the big moments. People tense up and they're like, you know, I think the goal is to race at the Olympics as hard as you can hope to race in practice. Mm-hmm. Right. And, and race day at the Olympics is like such an easy day. Like I said, okay, your training today is 1 2,000 meter piece.
Yeah.
And then you go home and I'm going to give you 48 hours to recover.
And did you feel like that during when you were racing, like that it felt like easy? Because of all your intense preparation, that by the time you got there, it was like, there's nothing left to do.
Well, to some extent, like in 92, our first World Cup, like we raced so much, like in 92, mm-hmm. like it, and I 100% know it's not the path this year, but we had like 18 or 19 international race starts in 92. And at we would go to a European, cup would have a full regatta Saturday and a full regatta Sunday. Mm-hmm. So you would do like, depending on the draw, like for the pair, it was usually heats, semis, cause we didn't do reps, but, heats, that's me being tongue in cheek there, but heats, semis, finals in the pair and heats and finals in the eight. So mm-hmm. five races on Saturday. And then, often it was, it was often just four races on Sunday because nobody else was doubling up. So there was fewer pairs on the Sunday. So then they would focus, there'd be more eights. So we would do five races on Saturday and four races on Sunday. So we do nine races in 2 days, right? That's what we did in Essen. And I remember sitting under a tree eating, like, this is so random. You know, sometimes you get to Europe and they'll have that big basket of green apples at the check-in desk, and we had all taken like 12 of them. So, but I'm sitting after racing eating like a green apple because it's nobody made us smoothies then. Yeah. You guys are so cushy. So I'm like, what, you get a replacement? Like I had a green apple after nine races. But sitting eating a green apple this British rower came over and she's like, are you the Canadian rowers that just doubled up in the pair and the four and the eight? And we're like, uh-huh. And she's like, oh, I just wanted to say, I think you're all stock raving bonkers. And I was like, that was one of my favorite things I ever heard in my whole career. I wanted to get a t-shirt that said stock raving bonkers.
That's so awesome.
But after that, we're like, so I get to go through the Olympics doing like one race a day, mm-hmm. like with days off. I can spend my energy and at that regatta in Essen, way back a long time ago, you asked me if I ever had any doubts, mm-hmm. if I ever gave up on the plan.
Yeah.
So one of those races was the pair final on the Saturday. So the fourth of five races on the first day. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the only time it ever happened in her career. So I'm throwing her under the bus on this one. Kathleen caught a crab at the start, mm-hmm. and we were behind. And we were the Germans who were there were the reigning world champions, and we're rowing along. And my job as bow, we had plan A, which is always like sprint for the finish. And plan B was like an energy management plan, right? And usually you would use it in a heat or a semi when you're qualifying. You don't have to do anything more. But I pretty much put us into plan B in the final, mm-hmm. knowing that we had the eight to come. And I was feeling pretty pooched. So, mm-hmm. and so I gave up on that, basically, like, we got second, but, mm-hmm. we didn't push for the finish and we came off and Al came over and he's like, what was that? And he was really mad at us. And I'm I told him what happened. And he's like, you were catching on them. You were closing the gap on them, even without training, we were plan B, just moving along. He's like, why? Like, don't ever do that again. Don't ever save energy for another race. And I was like, so mad at him. I'm like, but I'm like dead. Like, I'm all like, oh, like I'm booched here. I'm like, and then you go out for the 8 race. And, you know, during that 6 minutes, I realized I wasn't dead. I was actually contributing to the motion of the 8, and which meant I had stuff that I could give back to the pair. Mm-hmm. So I was learning in hindsight. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of those things I learned, never to save energy, never to conserve, you know, if there's not a legit strategic plan, you know, giving up is, it's not your decision. Yeah. You're just not qualified to know. You don't have enough information during the race to know how it's going and to know what the other boat's going to do. And you have to keep yourself in a position to take advantage of anything. And if you've checked out, then you may have given someone an advantage that.
Mm-hmm. I also, I feel like with the giving up, if you want to put it that way, I have fear towards that, because then I feel like if I do that one time, then my body or my mind is going to know what that feeling's like. Yep. And then I might do it again. And I'm like, I don't ever want to do that, because I just don't ever want to put myself in the position of feeling that feeling.
No, well, Christina, obviously you have done it, which is like, you're like, I don't want to feel it again. And I believe everyone has kind of quit once, right? So I remember quitting on an erg test, and I remember that race. And the thing is, if you quit once, you're cracked, right? That's okay. It becomes that that voice that reminds you why you don't want to do it. Like, I hated that feeling, so no, right? So you quit once, you're cracked, and you've quit like twice, maybe that's when you're broken. But I think, you know, my advice to you as a bow is really let yourself roll in the fact that you have a, like, there's what you want to say, and there's what the voice is going to say. And the voice is the one who's talking to the crew. Right. And you got to tell your, like, okay, so I know you guys really want me to say, you know, if like, you know, as we go through the 1,000, dig in here now. Right. But I'm going to say dig, right. You guys are smart enough to know when I say dig, it means dig in now. And I think, so the thing that I Kathleen and I knew was that within our race plan, I could say a word, a single word, and you had to really think about, how do you expel your words, right? There's certain consonants or vowels that I knew didn't come out well when my heart rate was at 205 beats per minute. Like, you're just like, I can't say that word, but I can say this word. And I know it's not the word you want, but you're smart enough to translate. So when I say this word, it means this paragraph, or it means this week of training. Like, I need, this word is not what we're doing. This word is the reminder of what you need to do, right? Like, and then you have to also be really clear about it, right? Because I remember bowing a boat and I would say lift, right? It was a great, Kathleen and I loved it, lift. And then it was the quad at the Pan Ams in 95, and it was like Silken and Diane and Wendy Wiebe and myself, and we were like thrown together, and I said, I'm gonna say lift. And I said, and then I was like, is everyone okay with that? And they're like, huh? And then after, finally, someone said, well, I was like, well, I said lift as we did our simulation. And I'm like, it didn't really seem to go well. And Diane, who's, you know, she's smarter than 12 people, but she finally goes, well, what did you mean by it? And so some people thought it meant lift the hands. Some I was thinking, like, you lift the body, the boat, and you lift the boat.
Yeah.
And, you know, Silken didn't know, like, but no one had asked. And I was like, so I'm really mad at them, because I'm like, I gave you an opportunity, right? Like, just if you don't, anyway, so that we had this, I remember that, but you know, you have to have this idea of, there's going to be a voice speaking, and what you want to do is crumple and like curl into a ball and die. But the voice is talking to you also. And that's part of what I learned on how to be, you know, a better bow and not to be a cow, was the voice has to be talking to me also. And people have to know that the voice is talking to me. And so you teach people that. You're like, okay, so I'm going to be saying this because I need to hear it. right? Mm-hmm. Like all your calls aren't for what your crew needs to hear. Some of your calls are for what you probably most of your calls actually are for what you need to hear, right? Like, right. And so the more your crew knows that you're talking to you as much as them, and that there's just this voice, right? And it happens to be like the fifth person in the boat. And when you guys are all like pooched and thinking you're good and done, the voice comes along and goes, okay, we got another 20 strokes left. Mm-hmm. And let's go. Time to like let's spark it up now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. I like the fifth voice in the boat. I think that's a really good approach. I wanted to talk about this summer as well, and your approach going into the games and your role as chef de mission and how that's been over the past couple years. Yeah, I say a couple of years because did you think that you'd ever have to do 2 years there?
No, it's ironic because when I was they finally got to the selection and I was selected as the mm-hmm. chef, I was a little annoyed because it was I wanted more time, right? Like I wanted to be selected more May of 2019, but I was selected in July of 2019. And then I really didn't get to start reaching out and communicating. My first letter to the athletes was in November mm-hmm. because they, you know, we had to let the Pan Ams kind of like finish up.
Yeah.
And I was like, November to July, I've got no time. And now I've had tons of time, but the messaging, I'm only now just coming into the type of messaging that I'd like to do, because it's all been, you know, you tell me, but I guess for a long time I had to sort of slide into a little more care and comfort, right? Mm-hmm. And care and comfort and inclusion. But realizing that within all of that, there's still, you know, this, I'm talking to a population of very focused and ambitious people, and you know, I remember my world as an athlete being very small. Mm-hmm. And so once you sort of figure out your routine, I can imagine that the pandemic's actually just affecting other people.
Totally.
And I mean that in a very respectful way. And I'm sure you see it in a very respectful way, but.
Yeah. Yeah. It just closes in our bubble even more, honestly. Like,
yeah.
Whether or not we would have been seeing people outside of rowing, now we'd literally just see rowers. And it's like that for the past year.
I had no non-rowing friends anyways. So
yeah.
I didn't see my family anyways.
So. Yeah. No, seriously. Like my roommates are rowers. We row in the same boat together. Like it's, yeah, you learn to really work with each other. And I'm going to be cognizant of time, but one of the main reasons why I actually, I wanted you on the podcast ever since I started the podcast, but probably in almost every episode, somehow you come up. Yeah. And it's not me that brings you up, but people, they're always like, oh, anything to, because they're trying to find an association with rowing or like how their sport relates to rowing. And they're like, oh, well, I know Marty McBean. And I had Tessa Virtue last week.
Okay.
I recorded with her and she was talking about how much you impacted her and her career. And I thought that was a really cool kind of resemblance between rowing and figure skating and how you brought in your partnership into her and Scott's partnership. And I think that's really special and really cool. And then this whole past year for me, I mean, the first time that when I found out about you being the chef, I mean, I wasn't even on the team and I was like, oh, that's so sick. Like I was still back at UBC and I was like, that's so cool that you're part of the entire representing the entire Canadian team. And then now being on the rowing team, and it's just really special for me as an athlete and knowing what you've accomplished and your impact on so many people and on the entire country is really, I have no words for it. So thank you. For the time and for the wisdom, and I look forward to more conversations and hearing more wisdom that you have.
Yeah, oh, please do. And I this is, you know, I'm going to outbow you here. I think you just wrapped up the podcast, but I'm going to say, you know, it's been really great for me. It's been a lot of fun because I don't get to talk about rowing very much. I, you know, often talk about sport in a more conceptual way, right? So if I'm talking with, you know, someone like Tessa, which she and Scott were great for also getting to me really think through sort of the theory of of a lot of things, right? So, but, you know, it is quite an honor to be representing and giving back to all sports, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, one of the big things, and I think you're probably figuring this out through the podcast, which is so much fun, just all the different sport cultures out there. And, you know, they're so different, right? Like, you know, how we keep people around us, like how close people are to our competition or our training or how many people are involved in what we're doing. It is just so different. And yet the foundation of our emotions going through it, like the, you know, like I sort of think that's where a lot of my confidence comes from in doing this, is understanding that we're all sort of following a framework of emotions, that ambition just, it's like this roller coaster, and it's not entirely predictable. But you can have a lot of empathy for other athletes and their journey. But yeah, so thank you for letting me talk about rowing.
Oh my gosh. Anytime.
and honestly, if you or Michelle or your crew or Terry, you guys call and pick my brain anytime. Like, this
awesome.
Is
awesome. Yeah, I appreciate that. And I mean, we're always looking for the extra edge, so we probably will.
Thank you, Marty, not only for taking the time to sit down and talk with me, but also for all the truth that you shared today. Your ability to reflect and understand your journey as an athlete is remarkable and is also a testament to the incredible impact that you've had on so many of us athletes. Thank you to my systems engineer, Sydney Payne, Claire Briand for background music, and a huge thank you again to all of you for tuning in. Have a wonderful day and go get after it. Thanks, everyone.